Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Today we talk about native plants and why they're so important to your garden and mine. Susan Carpenter back with us. She's the native plant gardening curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum in Madison. And, of course, we'll talk about what's happening at the Arboretum. We'll take your questions and comments, certainly. What would you like to know about adding native plants to your landscape? Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Susan Carpenter, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be here, Larry.
So what plants are popping up in the native gardens right now? Nothing in mine.
Well, it's very slow this year. One thing I reported that actually this was a couple weeks ago, the American hazelnut shrubs have started to bloom. So that's like one of the very first things that we look for. So far, it looks like we're on kind of a slow path towards spring, what with the a little bit of snow this morning again and continuing cool temperatures. But once we get some more sun, a little bit warmer, we're going to see things pop up pretty readily.
On my Facebook page popped up a photo from 5 years ago that I took. And on this day 5 years ago, I was in shirt sleeves. It must have been a weekend because I was playing golf with a friend. Not today.
Yeah, but it doesn't really, that's one neat thing about native plants is that, we worry sometimes about, when we're planting just our vegetables and so forth, we know we need to wait and patiently wait for real spring to get here. But the native plants really won't be affected by a late snow. They won't be affected by these cold temperatures. They'll just be, their buds are waiting right there under the soil surface for the most part, the prairie plants and the herbaceous plants. And the buds on the trees and the buds on the shrubs will all be, they're all just waiting. And you can kind of feel the excitement of spring, even though we're not quite there yet.
Michael in Fontana has a question. Let's go there. Michael, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I am planning a vegetable garden this year, kind of in the back of our horse farm, and it's unfortunately away from any fresh water source. And I was wondering if we could use the water that we typically use to water our riding arena, which is from a 5,000-gallon tank that we collect rainwater off our gutters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no that sounds good.
Yeah, there shouldn't be any problem with that, Michael. Mm-hmm. Rainwater is always it's kind of the best watering, isn't it?
Well, Susan? I think you've got you basically would be like having it rain on your garden, except that you've been holding it, for a short time. It's really great that you're collecting rainwater and reusing it. I mean, that's a very sustainable way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Go right ahead, Michael. Thanks for calling. So native plants, they provide an awful lot for birds, the animals, insects at this time of the year, or they can. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. Well, we still actually have, now that we have the migrating birds are starting to come back, and the birds that have been living here throughout the winter are active, of course, there's still seed available. And if you watch the birds, you can see which plants are kind of still holding some seed or where they're searching for seed. So if you leave the garden material up over the winter, as we usually do here in the garden, you'll see that birds and other wildlife will use those areas until, right up until the new growth is coming along. And right now, as far as insects go, there are insect larval stages and eggs, perhaps, and even in some cases, the adult form of the insect has overwintered. So they're in that material. They could be in that material as well, and so then they'll be hatching out. If we get some temperatures up above 50 degrees Fahrenheit for a few days, then we'll start to see a lot more of that, of those emerging from their overwintering.
You know, Mark, the IT guy in our department, just asked me this morning. He said, I've just got a balcony. What can I put out there? What are some good plants for containers on a balcony?
Yeah, well, I have written about that topic. So on our website, which is arboretum.wisc.edu, there's a couple of articles. If you just search on container gardening, those will pop up. And what I'd say in general about it is that if you can get containers and maybe planter boxes or, you know, fairly large containers, it's usually helpful to use some of the smaller plants. Like if you have a sunny spot, use some prairie plants that tend to be the smaller size, so like smaller grasses, like drop seed or little blue stem, June grass maybe. And you can use some of the smaller forbs, so like smaller blazing star, maybe some prairie smoke. And those are plants that are, most of those are adapted to kind of a dry environment, which could be what your containers would become, you know, if they're in the sun and they you might water them if there's no rain or if they can't get rain. You might water them a bit, but you wouldn't have to water them excessively because those are plants that are adapted to kind of a dry habitat. So I'd encourage looking into some of those, you know, some of those shorter and dry adapted plants.
Okay. So what about, what if we've got some land or some area there? What are a few plants gardeners could add to their garden that could maybe really help in the spring?
Well, in the spring, I'm often thinking about the pollinator resources because, as I mentioned, when the insects are emerging and, like, especially our ground nesting bees that come out in the spring, some of the very interesting solitary bees that nest in the ground are coming out, and these are not colony nesters, so they're just nesting one by one, and they use the spring ephemerals. So the native woodland plants, which actually are blooming in full sunlight because they bloom early in the spring before the trees have their leaves on. So often a home garden with big trees can handle some of those smaller plants that are just really blooming, actively growing in this early time of the year. So in late April, maybe quite late April this year, and yeah. May. And then they bloom and they actually senesce and finish up their life cycle. So they kind of take up time when maybe a lot of other things haven't gotten big or aren't really even going yet at that point. And then also not to forget the flowering trees like the wild plums, the serviceberry, which these are trees or large shrubs that bloom at this time of year. They bloom just before they get their leaves. So you see the flowers first and then the leaves are flushing on. So those are some good choices too, because when those bees come out and also our big queen bumblebees emerge in April, they need to find resources right away. They need floral resources, they need flowers, and then they'll be starting the bumblebees will be starting colonies, and the solitary bees will be starting their reproductive cycle for the next year.
Speaking of bees, David in Scandinavia called in and wondered how the bee population is doing. I think he was most interested in honeybees, but what about the bee population?
Well, as far as this year goes, we don't have, none of the native bees that I know of are emerged yet. I mean, I'd be glad to hear from any listeners who have seen some of the native bees out already. That would be very interesting. Honeybees, I have not heard any reports yet from people who are assessing the winter, you know, what happened over the winter with their hives. Again, I don't really study honeybees in detail. I work around them a lot because they enjoy native plants very much, but I don't know. I don't keep bees, and I don't know right now. I don't have any personal friends who are beekeepers, so I'm not up to date on that as far as this winter, you know, how the winter went for them. That's usually a, in recent years, that's been a crucial time for them. I think for the other pollinators, for the all the different pollinator groups, we're just going to have to see how the season goes. You know, they are resilient to some extent, but there are many forces that are, you know, that are causing declines in populations. So that's one of the reasons we encourage native plants, because it creates good habitat for them.
Yep, absolutely. Nancy at Mequon emailed, she needs some help with her coneflowers. She has them in multiple sites in her 2-acre yard, but none of them flowered last year. She has many other flowers, and they did just fine. And so she's just wondering, what the heck's wrong with the coneflowers?
Interesting. Well, I don't know. I guess my questions for her would be, how old are they? Are they, is this an established area of coneflowers, or are they relatively new, or, you know, were they newly seeded within a few years? It may take some time for them to develop. And I'd also wonder whether she's seeing the leaves. So I wish she were on the call so I could talk with her about those questions. But sometimes when plants are, you know, sometimes they might be affected by a pest or something, but you would see evidence of that, I would guess. And if you're seeing healthy vegetative growth, so the leaves are fine, the stems are fine, and they're just not producing any flowers, it could be that they're too young, or it could be that they're too crowded.
Mm.
And you might want to try dividing some out and moving them and seeing if that works. Also, I'd wonder if she has a cultivar of coneflower, or if they were the native, which native coneflower they were. So we have two native coneflowers. So
which are?
The pale purple coneflower and then the purple coneflower, which is pretty commonly grown in gardens too.
Yeah, there we go. Our guest today, Susan Carpenter, she is the native plant garden curator at the UW Arboretum. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Susan Carpenter of the UW-Madison Arboretum, our guest today. She's the curator for the native plant gardens there at the Arboretum, joining with us to talk about those native plants. Lots of callers coming up online. You can at 800-642-1234. You could also email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. The Arboretum is working with the UW-Madison Office of Sustainability to demonstrate and, I guess, teach about the biological and ecological value of lawns that include flowering species. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, this is an interesting trend. I know many listeners have probably heard about No Mow May, so it's somewhat related to that. We have our lawns here at the Arboretum. We don't have, I mean, compared to the 1,200 acres of the Arboretum here in Madison, we only have probably 40 to 45 acres of lawn. But they're maintained without fertilizer and without any herbicide. So we don't treat them, basically. And they're very robust, and we do mow, of course, but they have within them two kinds of clover. They have some creeping Charlie in spots. They have plantains. They have heal-all, which is another flowering species, and just other, and dandelions, of course. So what we're doing with the Office of Sustainability is we're looking at how, and that kind of lawn is a floral resource for pollinators. It's also not treated, obviously, so for our visitors and children and people just walking around. Sure. In our gardens, we are fairly certain that that's a healthier situation
sure.
of not treating that lawn. So what these lawns can do is actually they can be a living kind of a living part of the yard, as well as your flower beds and trees and flowering trees and so on. So that's the idea with the sustainability office. They have some students who are working on studying which plants are found in these lawns, and how are those lawns maintained, and also how do people think about those lawns in relation to a lawn that would be more of a single species, just say a single species of turf grass, and how do people feel about caring for lawns like that when they know that some of the benefits of those lawns. So it's a very interesting study to work with students and to work with the other university units and to see we've always done it this way, and we're not sure whether other areas of the university may be able to join us. Many of the new buildings on campus, when their landscaping goes in, they are using native plants in those plantings, so that's exciting. And then we'll just see if some of those lawn areas can be utilized or maintained as a more living type of lawn.
Hmm. Well, Bree in Green Bay, I believe, has a question. So let's go there. Bree, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first, I wanted to ask your guest if it's too late to plant wild lupine yet this spring. I got some seeds from my mom, and I have rhizobium inoculum. But I know that typically they're planted in the fall, but I was hoping maybe this cold weather would give me a little bit of time to try to plant those. The second question I have is my husband and I are planting a small cherry and apple orchard in our backyard, and if there are any specific native plants that we should consider for ground cover under those trees as they mature. Right now we're putting them into grass lawn, but would like to replace that.
Okay, a couple of good questions.
Great questions.
Yeah.
Okay, on the lupin, if it's usually recommended that you plant in the fall, I don't have in front of me the germination code for lupin right now, but you can look that up in a nursery catalog, one of the native plant nursery catalogs. The thing that's interesting about lupins is they have a very tough seed coat, and sometimes their germination requirement might be to actually break that coat to get them to break dormancy. They may have a temperature requirement too, and you'll see that in the germination code when you look that up. And if you have questions about how to look that up, you could email me in at the Arboretum and I can point you to the right spot. But one thing that we've done that I know we've done before with lupin seeds is actually to break that seed dormancy, just kind of a physical dormancy, is to put them in a dry, like a frying pan that's heated, and then, but not with oil or anything like that, and just put them in there and get them heated and like stir them around so they don't burn, and basically kind of treat them with heat. And it would be similar to having a fire that would go through. So and then that can help with breaking germination of that tough coat. But I would look, the place I would start, Bree, is to look up the germination code and see about the temperature. If you could possibly put them in the refrigerator or the, you know, to give them just a little extra cold, that might do it for this spring. Maybe you know, if you're further north, maybe you'd have enough cold to do. If it's only 30 days, you might make it.
Yeah, and if you could look, I mean, what do you do? Just could you type in germination code for lupin seed?
Yeah, what usually I do is on the Native Plant Nursery website, I just look up lupin, and then they have a little section for germination code. And then if you have to look up the code, it might say like C parentheses 30 means cold treatment for 30 days. and that tells you what you need to know. Or it might say C60, and that means 60 days of cold. Either way, you could plant them and then have them in wherever they're going to be, and then they would definitely go through next winter and be ready for next spring.
And what should Bree and her husband do in their small cherry and apple orchard in the way of in place of grass?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not too familiar with with growing apple and cherry as a crop. I know that putting something low underneath them is a good idea, just because of disease and that kind of thing. And also probably little mammals that would come and maybe damage the trees. So I have seen in orchards where they're where they have rows of apples, and between the rows they were using buckwheat, and that was to help. It's just an annual plant. They were using that to boost pollinator numbers, because it's very attractive to pollinators. And then it dies back, of course, and it's not a perennial crop. So I would advise looking into some of the extension materials. There's an excellent section on extension materials for actual apple growers and cherry growers, and I would look into that UW extension for the specific answer about what to put underneath them.
Yeah, I think if you go to the UW Learning Store.
And they have actually some workshops and webinars that are recorded. My daughter is also an apple orchard person, so I've been passing along some resources to her, but I don't have an orchard myself. So.
Okay, there we go. Bree, good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christy and Racine, your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live on Lake Michigan in Racine, and I'm just wondering, I know it's hard for the monarchs and possibly the birds when they're migrating across the lake or along the lake. Are there plants that are recommended for planting along the lake shore?
For those migrant insects.
Yeah, for the monarchs and birds that are you talking about when they come north?
Yeah. When they're returning
south. Well, the monarchs, from what I have learned about their fall migration, there are areas where they do have roosting, and that can vary really the kind of tree that they would use for the roosting kind of stopover. So I don't know if there's a specific type of tree, but those are generally larger trees. And I know that there is a flyway that's a little further inland from where you are, where monarchs are, usually traveling. I mean, you've probably seen them going along the lake too, right?
Yeah, and I found, last year especially, I found a lot of dead monarchs on my beach.
Oh.
And I'd like to avoid that. Or dying, because they just need food.
Right. Well, I guess the main thing I'm going to get to now is the way that, because planting a small tree to grow into a big tree isn't going to help monarchs like this year. But one thing it will help monarchs this year is to plant a lot of milkweed, whichever milkweed species are suitable for your location. So if you have a wet location, like the red milkweed, if you have a drier one or more medium soils, you can use a lot more of the species, even common milkweed, prairie milkweed. And then for the for dry sites, you might try the world milkweed and the butterfly milkweed. So there's different milkweeds that are commonly available that you could use, and a variety of them and as many of them as you can. That would be good for the reproduction of the monarchs. And then and then for their feeding, you just need native plants, flowers that they'll use all season long. And in the fall, the important ones for their fueling up as they're going south would really be asters and goldenrods, and then some of those late blooming things like jopaiweed, you know, that bloom kind of late in the season. So go for that, like, season-long blooms, and then don't forget the milkweeds for the caterpillars.
There you go, Christy. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Janie in Elkhorn next. Hi, Janie.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
My partner is a UW graduate, and we recently took out, we're on a farm, and we recently took out some old tree stumps, and I would like to plant natives, if possible, in honor of UW, but I can't, off the top of my head, think of anything in red. I wondered if you'd have any suggestions.
Well, red, bright red, badger red is not a super common color, but if you're willing to go a little into like purple red, or we do have one really bright red plant, and you need a little bit of a specialized area for it because it needs pretty consistent moisture, and that's cardinal flower. And it is a beautiful plant. It's in the Lobelia family, although it may have changed the family for that. Anyway, it's called Lobelia cardinalis, and it's the color of a cardinal. And it's a tall, about maybe 2 or 2.5 feet tall when it's blooming. And it has a bright red, you know, spike of flowers. And hummingbirds enjoy it. It's a gorgeous plant. And it'll grow with other natives like mountain mint, culver's root, and other, you know, other native plants that appreciate that same kind of habitat. When you're getting into the other kinds of, there's other plants that are sort of more purple red and those, but that's the bright red one that I can think of.
And then that, it what is it like? Does it like dry soil?
Wet
soil.
Wetter, moister soil, yeah, like wet side of medium. Or sometimes in a kind of like on the north side of a house, if it's a little bit shaded, if there's a little bit of shading to the south of the site, then you can have kind of a microclimate effect, and it will do fine there as well.
All right. Janie, does that help out?
That helps. The sites I'm eyeing are actually in full sun. The soil here is a little heavy, so I think I could probably keep it wet enough.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see what we can do. And for I believe it was Christy and Racine, mm-hmm. I've seen clusters of monarchs on red pine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't last very long. They just, you know, are migrating.
Yeah.
But if there's a cold snap, they tend to. That's what I've seen, at least in my limited experience.
Very cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Janie. Appreciate your call. Well, Judy in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. The question I have is, I have some white pine trees that have, and I live in the village, so I have a couple pine trees that have grown up to a point where there's quite a bit of drop needles mm-hmm. underneath them. And I was just wondering if there's any kind of native plants that would thrive in that environment.
If you have, basically you're saying that the needles have really kind of, they're going to be a real factor in with the soil of this. Is it a very shaded area?
Underneath them it is.
Yeah.
I mean, is it like a grove of them, or is it like a line of them, or?
Yeah, it's just basically like two.
Okay.
And I started out with a lot of prairie plants because they were very, very small when I moved into the house.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately or unfortunately, they've gotten to the heights now where they're starting to shade out some of my prairie plants. But for the most part, they're still doing really well. But I just didn't know what I could maybe plant under there if I removed some of that needle bed or.
Yeah, I mean, you might just experiment with that a little bit. It seems like it's probably. It may seem like a thick bed of needles, but it might be not really affecting the soil all that much, you know, since it's not like a deep forest of pine needles, you know, it hasn't been going on for that long. And I would say, and then maybe as you've noticed, some of the prairie plants are probably shaded out or, you know, not as shade tolerant, and others are. And if you move into more of the savanna species, too, and if you don't have any of those yet, that might be a good way to transition into something that, you know, where your ground layer is more shaded than it was when you started. But I would just experiment with that, because I think the pine needles are probably not, you know, given the history there, it doesn't sound like they're probably would affect the soil too much beyond what you've, you know, what success you've already had.
There you go. Judy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. Open lines will get you on pretty quickly now as we talk native plants with our guest, Susan Carpenter. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Terry in Roberts emailed. She was really glad you mentioned Creeping Charlie. She has quite a bit of it in her yard. Is there any good reason to remove it? She doesn't. Uses it in containers as a trailing vine. She thinks it's beautiful.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. I, you know, as a gardener, of course, I think we all kind of have a little, you know, visceral reaction to weeds. And at first I think I was like, oh, we just got to, you know, keep after that. And then I got involved about 10 years ago with bumblebee conservation. And I learned that as it's blooming right about the time that the queen bumblebees are, the new queen bumblebees are emerging from the overwintering chambers, and they use it as a floral resource, just like they'll use any other flower that's available that they, you know, that they can use. And they're very easy to see on Creeping Charlie, and they're very easy to photograph, which is how we document and monitor bumblebees. So I became a much bigger fan of Creeping Charlie at that point. And I usually let it bloom out, and, you know, you can always be removing it. But I often ask the audience when I'm giving a presentation, if there's any gardeners there who have actually ever been totally successful in getting rid of it, and nobody ever raises their hand. So I think it's individual preference. But I guess I agree a bit with Terry that I've seen a role for it with pollinators, and just more the ability to see our queen bumblebees as they're emerging, and they're kind of hard to see if they're up in the top canopy of a large tree. So,
they're the first things to bloom practically in the spring.
Very early.
So I, at one point in my life, I tried to eliminate it, and that was, and now I just let it go. And you do see a lot of insects on it in the pollinators on it in the spring when it's blooming. So.
And there is a stage of its life after it's done blooming when it sends out its runners along the soil. You know, that's kind of the expansion phase. And at that point, if you're a gardener and you want to, like, keep it from, you know, expanding even further, that's a good time to just start picking those things up off the ground, because they're not highly rooted yet.
Yeah.
So just a key time to, like, you know, do a little bit of management on it.
Yeah, done that with my daughter, and you'd be amazed how much you can pick up in even 15 minutes of time, let alone an hour.
Yep.
Oh, boy. Catherine, in Middleton, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I wanted to just comment on a couple of things. The royal catchfly is a native plant that does really well at least in our yard, in a variety of soils, including some clay, and it also spreads. It's a beautiful little flower that the hummers love and butterflies love.
And it's
so
red.
I wanted to mention
it's
royal
red.
Catch flower. Very red, and it's so pretty. And that was one thing. And then I wanted to mention, I just get excited listening to all of this, but under pine trees, you can plant wild ginger, which is a wonderful ground cover, as long as the needles aren't too thick. but that has done very well for us under some pines that we planted along the road. So
there we
a great
a
suggestion.
Of comments. I really don't have a question, but I love talking about native plantings. So anyway, I wanted to just pop in.
Thanks. You, Catherine. Yeah, that was great. Appreciate that call very much. Kara emailed, they're redoing their yard this spring. They're putting in a swimming pool and also planting as many natives as they can. But it recently occurred to her they might be attracting pollinators with natives and then poisoning them when they drink the chlorinated pool water. Is that something to worry about? And if so, anything she could do to steer them away from the pool?
Yeah, I think that I think they would probably be, if they find them in the pool, I think it's more accidental than drinking, using as drinking water. So I would think that the pool won't be a terrible hazard for the general population of insects there. Not that they won't find some, but you know, that's it's a large body of water in.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, most of the pollinators are not, like the bees are not actually actively seeking water sources like that. There's water on plants. They are drinking nectar, which has, it has a water component to it. It's not like, you know, it's sweet, but it's not sugar, you know, it's not solid sugar. So there's water within that. So I would encourage her to, I think the benefits of having the natives around the, around the yard and around the landscape is greater than the dangers to the pollinators from the pool.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Barb in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. My question is, I have a backyard where along the south side, I've got 3 4x4s. And around the north side of the walkway, I've got black-eyed Susans and daisies. I want to put in more flowers that are natural, and I'm kind of wondering what you'd suggest.
Okay. Is the area shaded or sunny?
No.
Okay.
It's the only place in my whole backyard that's sunny.
Full sun. Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, given what's growing there, that sounds successful. Well, I think you could probably and what type of soils do you have? Medium or?
It's stupid clay from.
Clay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the first 2 inches, 3 inches are a little bit better, but it's clay.
Well, clay is not a real problem for, some native plants will like a really well-drained soil, so you'd want to avoid those. So some of the, you know, the dry prairie plants, et cetera, you would probably not want to use. But I've got encouraging news about the clay. If you do establish your native plants there, they will soon create more porous soil in that area. Because their root systems will enlarge and expand, and as the roots, grow and then die back and grow and die back and so forth through that root system, there will be a lot more infiltration in that area. So I would look for plants that there are actually in the native plant nursery catalogs. You can often search on clay tolerant plants or even a mix that has. Like a seed mix would be listed that are plants that can do well in clay, and that will get you started. And then from there, the plants will probably also modify the soil a bit, so that might make it possible for some other types. So I would look up, plants that do well in clay or a mix that does well in clay, and then see what species you might want to select from that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Barb, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan Carpenter, our guest today, native plant gardening curator at the UW Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Susan Carpenter, native plant garden curator at the UW Madison Arboretum. questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Richard in Colfax will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi, and thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to the program. I listen most days, and I just love it. I wanted to mention a plant that blooms very early, and the queen bumblebees absolutely love it. And I see they're breaking the ground already next to my foundation. And I don't think the deer bother them. I've seen them down in the woods, too. And that's Virginia bluebells. I mean, they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the queen bumblebees absolutely love them. They're usually the first flower out here in my area.
Yes, that is a really great species. If people are interested in attracting those, that's one of the spring ephemerals that I mentioned earlier. And it Virginia bluebells is terrific because it's a fairly tall plant, maybe a foot or even a little taller than that. And it has lots of flowers on each and the clusters of flowers on each stem. And they're blue, and bumblebees are very fond of blue, white and purple flowers, especially early in the season. So that is a great suggestion. And you do need to see it early because it is one of those that the leaves will fade away after it blooms. And so we've really only got about 6 weeks of enjoyment to admire it and to have the bees visiting that plant.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a bunch, Richard. Appreciate it. The all this talk about plants reminded me of plant sales.
Yep.
Lots of groups have plant sales this time of the year. Arboretum is no exception. And after a 2-year hiatus, it's back, and it's on my birthday, May 14th.
Oh, yes. Well, that's good. Well, happy birthday. We will be back in the big tent, and this is right at the Arboretum Visitor Center, and this is our tent sale. So people who ordered plants early in the year will be picking up the week prior, but that Saturday will be gathered, and from 10 to 2 is the plant sale, and we invite everyone to come and pick out some good plants for their yard or the landscape or their containers, whatever gardening they can do.
Yeah, it's always kind of a nice time to visit anyway. You've got, it's usually smells really great that time of the year.
Yes, usually we have a pretty good display going on in the horticultural collection by that time, and many of the smaller native plants are up by that time, so it's a good time to take a walk and take in the sale and go home and plant some of those plants in your yard.
Yeah, it's perfect. So it's May 14th, that's Saturday, from 10 to 2. Let's go to Heather in Brookfield next. Hi, Heather.
Hi. Thank you so much. I recently, a couple of years ago, planted a butterfly garden at a school, at a children's school, and it's been doing so great. We got some little plugs from the Milwaukee, the MMSD plant sale, native plant sale, and
sure,
they've been doing so great. I brought in a bunch of mulch. I don't know if it was the mulch or just around the area, but we have a thistle explosion that I'm trying to manage. Do you have any tips or things that you've done to manage those thistles? I mean, I'm sure the insects love them, but unfortunately the kids want to avoid the area as much as possible if there are thistles.
Right.
So.
Now, I'm curious as to which kind of thistle it is. Is it Canada thistle, which would be like stems spreading throughout the whole area?
I don't know the exact kind, but they are tall. They get to be about 6 feet tall. And I pull them and I pull them, and I almost wonder if my pulling them is making it worse because it seems like they create these patches.
Yeah.
And reemerge.
Yeah, I think with the description of the thistles that you're now, do you have some that are on the ground that are just like a small circle of leaves that are kind of more flat on the ground at first, and then it puts up that big stalk the next year, or because there are some native thistles that fit the description of, you know, 6 feet tall with a lot of branching and blooms on the top of them. The thing to remember about those is they are that's a two-year cycle. So that tall plant that's blooming is the end of the line. So if you can, you know, when you see that thing coming up, if you take that one out, then that plant is gone. It doesn't have a root system that's continuing on around the garden. If it's Canada thistle, then it's spreading by root system, yeah. And that's a little different strategy. I can see how in a children's garden, where you want children to be really interacting with the plants and all, it would, you know, that's a sort of special case of maybe managing even the native thistles to not have them. When I get native thistles here in the native plant garden, unless they're right near the path and they'll be brushing against people with the spines and all, I usually let them bloom and flower, because I've never actually planted a native thistle in this garden. They've just come. So if I know it's a native thistle, then I might go ahead and leave it, because they are so important, you know, biologically and ecologically. But if it's Canada thistle, we're not in favor of it, because it is a rhizomatous plant and it spreads by, but it's usually not 6 feet tall. It's usually more like at the most three or four feet tall.
Yeah, about
so
four.
I think if you could, Heather, if you could email me a picture of it, I would be glad to try to identify it more carefully and give you some advice on that.
Yeah, that makes good sense. If you've got some photos from last year.
Yeah, of the garden in general, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And how does she do that, by the way?
You can just, if you just email me at the Arboretum, my listing is there, but my email is susan.carpenter@wisc.edu, and just attach a picture and we'll take a peek at it.
All right. susan.carpenter@wisc.edu. There you go, Heather. Sherry in Mount Horeb, thank you for calling.
Hi there, you bet.
What can we do for you?
I live out in the country in Mount Horeb, and I'm ready to eliminate a little bit of my lawn and would like to start a small prairie area. And just wondering how to go about that. Do I need to kill the grass first? I want to put in some native grasses and a few native plants and black-eyed Susans and stuff, and just wondering how to start that.
That's a great question, because site preparation is so important. And if you've done a good job of, you know, matching, it sounds like you've got an open area. If it's just full sun, then picking those prairie plants is a good choice. There's a couple ways to do the preparation if you're starting from turf grass, and one is to smother the area. So that would be covering it. And using, you know, cardboard, maybe putting mulch on it just to hold it down or tack it down. And so that would take a few months to kill turf grass. Another thing you could do is use a sod cutter. And this all depends on how big the area is, how much you're tackling it all at once. If you're just creating a bed, maybe it's not worth, you know, bringing a sod cutter over. But we did a new garden here last summer, and we had about 1,200 square feet was our estimate of the size. It was kind of an oval shape, so we could have been off on the estimate a bit. But we used a sod cutter for that. And, of course, then there were some weed seeds that got released during as the sod was removed. There were some weed seeds within that soil, and those started to germinate. And so I had a good weeding project on my hands there for a while. But that's another option, just simply rolling the sod off of the area, because the sod has very, very short little roots. And you can remove, if you just use a sod cutter or even a shovel, depending on how big it is, you can remove that sod and you'll have an area to work with. If you're starting with if you're going to be planting small plants, that will be a good technique, because the plants will grow really fast and begin to shade out where the bare soil is. And you can also put some native seeds on that bare soil and then get them going in the in-between places between the small plants if you're using plugs.
Yeah,
there's also a lot of good information about this with the native plant nurseries. Do a very good job on their websites of talking about how to start a new garden, and there's also books about how to start new gardens. But you've really identified a key part of the process. Your success is mainly going to be based on how you know preparing it and also matching your plants to your site.
Yeah. That is the critical thing, that if you do it right to begin with, you're going to be a lot happier, Sherry, with the final result. That's for sure. You don't want to skimp on preparing that soil bed. Well, Susan Carpenter is our guest. Susan is the native plant garden curator at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Don't forget their plant sale. I just want to mention that, too, on May 14th from 10 to 2. I'm Larry Mueller here for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Carpenter. She's the native plant garden curator at UW Arboretum in Madison. So, what native plant questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. You know, Susan, we had, as you remember, we had a caller wanting to know about some really bright red flowers, natives, that she could use to kind of support the UW in a way. And a caller suggested, another caller suggested bee balm as another red option. And there are some bee balms that are pretty red. I don't think there may not be as red as the royal catchfly, but close.
Yeah. There are some cultivars that are the red Monarda, so that would be an option. And I don't grow the red one. It's not technically a native, so I'm just growing the one that's more of a lavender. That is a terrific plant for bees. But I have talked with many gardeners, kind of a range of gardeners, and it's interesting because some of them say that the bees really use the red Monarda quite a bit, and others say that they notice the bees don't use it as much. So that would be something very interesting for listeners to chime in on. If it is true that some of our cultivars of native plants, naturally occurring, you know, variations of the native species, are used now, you know, in the horticultural industry, because, you know, we as gardeners, we like to see a lot of variety in our gardens. We like to try new things and so on. As a native plant gardener, I'm pretty much just using the straight species. But there are some studies now being done comparing cultivars to the straight species and seeing, like, well, are they used by pollinators and are they used more? Are they valuable? Are they less valuable? And so on. So those are some good questions to ask. And I usually encourage people to just do some observations in their own garden. You know, you're not maybe going to be doing a full-fledged scientific research trial, but you can either check the literature for some of this information that's coming out now, or just to make observations yourself, to have the native species, have the cultivar, and see what your insects do on those. And I usually decide that if I have a plant that is not attracting any insects, have flowers that are not being used by any insects whatsoever, then I'm kind of encouraged to replace it with something that is.
Makes good sense. Mm-hmm. Makes good sense. Barbara in Boscobel has a question or comment. Barbara, hi. Thank you for calling.
Barbara? That has an earthen ramp up to the second story, and it's kind of steep on the sides. So I was looking for possibly some native plants that we could plant that would help support the earthen structure to prevent erosion and also to help us avoid having to mow on those steep sides of the ramp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my first questions about that would be to think about what kind of light is it getting? Is it on the north? You know, is it north facing? Is it south facing? That'll
it's
help.
Southwest.
Okay, southwest facing. And it's a steep slope and it's in full sun?
Yes.
Okay. So the soil is, what kind of soil would you describe it as?
It's not clay. It's a combination of black dirt. And
so kind of a medium moisture holding soil.
Right.
Okay. So maybe medium to dry possibly, because if it's southwest facing and full sun, it's going to be getting a lot of light and it'll be warming. And because it's a slope, it might be draining better than if it were just a flat of surface. So you might want to, and then I don't know how tall you would want the plants to be. So if you don't want them to be, you know, 4 feet tall or 5 feet tall, then again, here you might want to go with shorter species, you know, some of the shorter prairie grasses, some of the shorter prairie forbs or forbs that, you know, the flowering plants that are where the leaves are kind of a short, you know, maybe up to 2 feet tall, and then maybe just the flowers are more delicate and coming up, you know, to get a little taller than that. So it kind of depends on whether you want to have tall plants there or short plants, but you might, you know, if you don't want to think about how it will look and if it's right near the house, you know, how you want it to, you know, whether you're looking over it to have a view from the house. I just don't know the situation, but those would be some things I would think about. And then it sounds like you could use prairie plants that appreciate a dry or, you know, drier or dry mesic, dry medium type soil moisture.
All right. Barbara, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was going to put in a new native bed this year, and I had a plan that involved a narrow-leaf blue-eyed grass, and I can't find that anywhere. They're sold out, like the prairie nursery are sold out. So I'm looking for, I liked it because it was low-growing, early blooming, and would accept partial sun because I have a lot of trees around my yard. So I'm hoping you can give me some alternatives, low-growing, partial sun, early blooming.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you one thing about the blue-eyed grass, not to discourage you from that, because I have that one at my house. I planted a small area of it some years ago, and it seeds itself like crazy. So if you can get a hold of some seeds of that plant, you might be able to still go with that. It's a little, it's called blue-eyed grass, but it's not really a grass. It's a little tiny member of the iris family. So when you look at the leaves, you can see that flat structure of the leaves, just like a bigger iris would have. And the little capsules that it produces, the little fruits that it produces, have a number of seeds in them, and they kind of break open at maturity, and they scatter around quite well. So might check out some seeds of that, even if you can't get the plants, and it may do well. So low growing and semi-shaded, is that correct?
I believe so.
You might be able to go with some like wild strawberry, perhaps, or maybe some Jacob's ladder would work there. That can go in a semi-shaded area. And I don't know if prairie smoke would work in your particular spot, but I've had some success with that.
Worth a try.
In quite a range of areas. So it kind of depends on how tall you want to get after that. Some like a woodland phlox might be another possibility.
Yep. There's another one. Sue, thank you. Good luck, by the way. Thanks for calling. Barry in Apple Valley, Minnesota. On to you.
Oh, hi. Does that bell indicate anything of significance? Have I won anything?
No.
No?
No, but we'll give you some good advice. That's your winning prize.
That's my investment, and I'm glad to be able to speak about this. I live in a townhouse, and the townhouse has a very minimal area that's green, and yearly everything gets destroyed around here by the sand and the gravel and the salt. So what I'm thinking about in a 15 by 15 foot area, for example, maybe I can put together 3 or 4 platforms that would be a raised garden. And since it's exposed on all sides, I'd expect it to freeze and everything that's been planted and grown to die off. But in the interim, from June, let's say, to October or September, I could have some annuals or maybe perennials, which I'd have to give up on a yearly basis, to attract migratories, the songbirds, or hummingbirds. And I'd have to build the whole soil structure as well as mulch it. What would that profile look like? How thick would I want that soils to be? And does this make any sense?
Well, if you're basically talking about building sort of a giant raised bed area.
Not one continuous one, but 3 smaller platforms.
Okay.
Maybe
okay.
One would be 2 by 3.
I see. They have as you point out, if they are exposed, you know, and they're raised, they might that may be a more severe winter situation than what it would be if they were, you know, in the ground. But it sounds like you'd probably be doing more annuals in that area. And if you wanted to do that, you might be looking at, I think then you're just really looking at specific species. If you want to attract hummingbirds, you might specifically look for things that would go for hummingbirds like salvias or other species. You could try some perennials because it's not a guarantee that they would be killed, but I would take a go slow approach on that and, you know, try a few things that catch your interest and see if they work. Because it could be that they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't die off, and then you'd have a perennial base as well as any annuals that you added.
Yeah. Might even be able to provide a little insulation around the outside too, as fall ends up.
I mean, you are up in Minnesota, so your zone might be a little bit harsher than here, but it's
you
not
know
too,
your zone,
not,
by the way?
Not too different. Yeah.
Zip code?
No. Your growing zone.
Your growing zone.
5.
I'm really not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure
you might look that up because that might help you, you know, pick plants that are that are hardy at that zone for sure. And, you know, with the natives, like pick natives from your particular area so that it's actually not too different from our area in terms of the growing zone. So I think some of the species, you know, just general species, but do focus on the Minnesota ones or the more northern ones, because that will help you get more success probably than, you know, just a general pretty plant that would grow some.
Actually, I just quickly checked, and you're a 4B in Apple Valley.
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm. So you got lots of opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the latitude that you guys are at? Where's the University of Madison, for example?
We're at a 5A, so that's a little bit warmer than what you have. Although the particular spot can matter a lot. Like if you're against caller mentioned, he's got bluebells coming up already against the house. So there's a little microclimate there, which is a little warmer. And maybe your spot would have a similar feature, you know, since you're in a built environment there.
Yeah.
With more heat and reflection off the buildings themselves.
Yep. There you go. 4B, that's...
Experiment.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much. Good luck, Barry. Appreciate it. By the way, Teresa in Fort Atkinson emailed, she has a prairie smoke in her rock garden that's blooming right now.
Hooray.
She'd like,
wonderful.
Yeah, she wanted some help on the west side of her house. It's heavily shaded in the morning and early afternoon. Gets a little sun about 10 or 11, then at about 2 on, it's sunny. Something like a grass or sedge to fill in next to a path that she has.
Yeah, I have an area similar to that where I might suggest usually they say that if you have more than 6 hours of sun per day on the spot, it counts as full sun. But some of these areas are tricky where you get full shade and then it's a little bit sunny and then it's full sun because it changes so much during the actual season. It's not like that a whole season. The sun's angle is changing all the time. So I would maybe suggest Sprengel's sedge, which is a sedge about it's not a huge one, but it's not tiny. It's maybe a foot, grow up to a foot tall. It blooms early in the season, but it will grow in some shade for sure. I do recommend it for like semi-shaded gardens, but it can tolerate having that angled sun, you know, later in the day. So she might try that one for sure. And maybe prairie drop seed as a grass that would work in that situation too, because it's got a pretty good light, tolerance of different amounts of light.
There we go. Larry in Bloomington, Minnesota. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Enjoy the show. Yeah, I have two questions quickly. First of all, about cultivars you mentioned, and I know some are very beautiful flowers and colors, but I've heard that they're not always as long-lived, and then related to that, then they revert back to true breeding if they reproduce. I'm sorry, back to the native variety. And my second question involves oxeye daisy, which grows beautifully on distressed areas. You see them all over Wisconsin, Minnesota, on the roadsides. But what's your opinion on putting those in a perennial garden since they're not native, but they look very beautiful early in the spring?
Yeah, on the oxeye daisy, I would not encourage it if you want if you want to focus more on natives, or even in my experience, it can get kind of aggressive,
yeah.
and then you have a challenge of like keeping other things growing with it. So I know it's beautiful, but there are many other beautiful things that won't act like that. So I think I would recommend something that's a little less aggressive in relation to other, the other plants you're trying to grow. With the cultivars, it's a good point about the fact that they may not be as long lived. They may also, depending on how they originated, they may not breed, you may not be able to collect the seed from them to grow them again as you could with your native plants. And I'm really, especially now that we have the jumping worm as an element in some of our areas, we aren't digging up plants and sharing them with our friends quite as much. So sharing seeds is a way that we can share plants. So I do think that if you have the straight species and you can harvest the seeds from those and you can share those with folks, that is a very nice feature. And that might not be possible with a cultivar or what they call a nativar.
Mm-hmm. There, Larry, thank you for calling. Kathleen in Fifield, hi.
Hi, Larry. I have a couple of comments on the Monarda. The bee balm, I have a west-facing backyard that is nothing but Monarda. It spreads so well. Actually, I love it. And I have some phlox mixed in with it. And mine is red. The Monarda is red.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to mention that it does spread. And so if you have like a little pasture or something, that's just perfect. That'll fill that in time quite quickly, actually. And also the Monarda is really great for hummingbirds. My backyard is usually just filled with them when they're in bloom, when the Monarda is in bloom.
Good point. Great.
Excellent points.
That must be fun to see.
You had something about zones that you wanted to mention, Kathleen?
Yes. I don't hear much about what zones these plants are recommended for or not recommended for. And that's with a lot of the garden shows and everything. When something's recommended, I don't hear what zone or zones they would be suitable for.
Yeah, with the native plants, we don't really use the zone system as much as the as whether the plant is native to the area that we're talking about. So if I get a question from northern Wisconsin, I have to kind of put my mind, you know, switch my mind to thinking of the northern vegetation, and southern Wisconsin, of course, think of the southern part of the state. Or if we're moving further south, even someone is interested in a question from, say, southern Illinois, that can be different, you know, a different area. So I don't use the zones as much with native plants, although it's a good way. A lot of gardeners like to talk about it. So they say, oh, well, it, you know, what zone is this, when they come to see the native plant garden here at the Arboretum, because they're thinking about it in terms of their own home garden and where, you know, whether the plants would work there or not. You can, a lot of times, if the zone isn't mentioned with a ornamental plant, you can look that up pretty readily, and there should be pretty good agreement. Usually the zone would be a range of zones, not just a single zone. So that's good, because then that gives you a little bit more leeway as to whether it'll work in your area or not.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the zones are changing over time.
Yeah, they've changed a bit. The new zone map is different from the old one, that's for sure.
So, yep, we got to keep up with that, too.
So, I'm nice to see the garden tours at the Arboretum are back. Maybe in our last minute, you could talk about what you've got lined up and how people can register.
Well, for our garden tours, you don't have to register. So you just have to get the schedule, and the schedule's on our website, which is arboretum.wisc.edu. And the first one coming up is on April 23rd, and that is in our Longenecker Horticultural Garden, so our big ornamental garden, and a collection of trees and shrubs. So we have more than 80 magnolia trees in that collection. And David Stevens, who's the garden curator there, will be leading that tour. So you will learn more than you've ever known before about magnolias. And there's, of course, all the different forms of them and the different colors and the different stories that he'll have to tell you. And then the next tour after that is on April 30th. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mention what time these garden tours are. These are Saturdays from 1 to 3.
Okay.
So April 30th from 1 to 3, I'll be leading a tour of early signs of spring in the native plant garden. And so we'll be poking around for any signs of spring that we can find. And who knows, if we get a few weeks of warmer weather here, there could be quite a few things to look at. But that is an interesting tour, because we just never know on that first tour what we'll see.
Susan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit. And just a reminder, don't forget about their native plant sale May 14th from 10 to 2. Susan Carpenter is the native plant garden curator at the UW Arboretum. Taking a look ahead to Monday at this time, we'll talk with Jesse LeGrew about phishing emails, how to identify them, and how to protect yourself against them. And of course, he'll take your other questions you might have about your computer or your software. That's Monday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, I hope you stay with us through the afternoon. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.